This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 72 was recorded on July 13th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. We got a fantastic show lined up for you this week, folks. With so many geopolitical hotspots developing around the world, we decided to bring back our favorite geopolitics expert for this week's featured interview. Dr. Pippa Malmgren has served as an economic advisor to multiple U.S. presidents and has served in senior economic and political advisory roles around the globe. Pippa and I will discuss everything from the future of the European Union to cryptocurrencies to the economic impacts of President Trump's border wall on the Texas-Mexico ecosystem. And to cap it all off, you're going to hear what really goes on inside the so-called plunge protection team from a veteran insider who actually served as a member of the PPT. But be sure to stay tuned in after the feature interview when Patrick and I will be going deeper into the subject of cryptocurrencies, a subject that I've recently changed my view on. Now, this episode is going to run a bit longer than usual because we really went into a lot of detail on cryptocurrencies in the post-game segment, but I really think that you'll find it worth your time.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Now, Eric, we have so much content this week, so we're going to have to keep the market wrap down a little tight. So why don't you share with us what you think are some of the key highlights of what's happening this week in the markets?
Sure. Let's start with equities. As I said last week, I was leaning much more toward a move to new all-time highs as opposed to the market rolling over, as so many people thought. And that's exactly what's happened. You know, one of the best-known adages on Wall Street is that calling tops and bottoms is amateur league, and true professionals know to wait for a trend to be established. Yet even though they commonly give that advice, some of the most famous experts have been calling for a top. So, you know, I do think that this market is ridiculously overvalued. That doesn't mean that it can't continue. What we have to be looking for is what's the catalyst that's going to induce a significant correction or even a bear market. And I haven't seen it yet. The collapse of the GOP health bill clearly wasn't enough. The debt ceiling, that might be a more realistic trigger. We'll see what happens. As far as the dollar index is concerned, last week we were trading on a 95 handle. We thought it might base there, but I was leaning more on a breakdown further to the downside. A week later, we're barely hanging on to a 94 handle, 94.08, as we're speaking Thursday afternoon. I think that we could still see this move a little bit lower, but we're really getting to a point where the technicians I'm reading are saying this is probably played out. On the daily RSI, we're already in an oversold condition. So, you know, does it really have further to go? Or are we hitting the end? I'm not really sure. Certainly, if we get down to a 92 handle, I'm going to start, you know, accumulating, not necessarily because I think a bottom is in, but if you don't really have a very clear price target, you got to start someplace. Moving on to crude oil. I said last week that I thought the 50-day moving average would hold at 46.60. If it didn't, we'd move higher, and of course it didn't. The next thing to come into play was probably about a 47.75 to 48.25 target, which would be channel resistance. DOE inventory came in 4.7 million barrel drawdown. Furthermore, the API the day before had reported a 1.6 million barrel build. So that really kind of shocked the market higher, totally took out the 50-day moving average. We moved very quickly up to that 47.75 level, which was the next target. As we're speaking Thursday afternoon, that was rejected fairly strongly. It looks like maybe the top is in. Maybe we've got one more push up to a low 48 handle, but I do think this is going to roll over, and I think that we're headed lower. Production did tick up again this week to a two-year high. Nobody seems to have noticed. The rig count is still on the increase. And in general, I think the glut is back on, folks. Reality hasn't really set in completely yet because we've had these headline inventory numbers that are not helping. You've got to remember from a seasonal standpoint that the seasonal pattern of drawdowns in inventory is going to be replaced. Summer driving season only has another week left in it. It doesn't seem it because from a driving standpoint, obviously, there's another 6 weeks. But from a refining standpoint, the gasoline that will be sold on Labor Day weekend in the United States will be refined from oil that's being bought and sold this week and next week. So summer driving season is almost over from a crude oil standpoint. Moving on to gold. there's one where we missed the call last week, frankly. I really thought as we were looking at the chart, and I think you echoed this too, that we were going to roll back over and go below 1200. And of course, what we've seen is a major move to the upside, well above the 200-day moving average now. A lot of people are attributing this to the dollar index or the GOP healthcare bill. That's nonsense. If you look at where the moves happened in gold, it was not coincident with the big moves down in the dollar index or with the announcement of the healthcare bill falling through. So I think this is just delayed reaction to first Janet Yellen turning more dovish in her Humphrey Hawkins speech and then Mario Draghi this morning turning dovish. Finally, Treasury yields were back down to the low 2.20s. I think 2.25 as we're speaking Thursday afternoon was lower than that earlier in the week. We still have the trading range 2.12 to 2.40 is the range. I think we're more likely to break out towards the low side, but it remains to be seen.
Thanks for the market update, Eric. Now back to join us again as this week's featured interview guest is Dr. Pippa Malmgren, founder of the DRPM Group and author of the book Signals, and one of our favorite geopolitical commentators. Eric's interview with Dr. Malmgren is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Dr. Pippa Malmgren, founder of DRPM Group and colloquially known to the Macro Voices team as the goddess of all things geopolitical pertaining to markets. So, Pippa, thanks so much for coming back on the program. It's great to have you. And we had your dad on the program. I want to mention to our listeners, if you didn't listen to that one, you and your dad's interview together was fantastic. Between the two of you, I think you've advised more U.S. presidents than anyone else I can think of. And just the background and experience that you bring to the table was really great. So I'm really looking forward to this interview as well. Let's start with Europe. You know, we've heard from Grant Williams, the end is nigh, and Brexit was the event, the catalyst that's going to bring about the complete demise of the European Union over time. It seemed for a while like Europe was falling apart at the seams. Then Macron won the French election and the euro is rallying. A lot of people say it's all better now. What's the real story? What is your outlook for the European Union, both short, medium, and long term?
Well, I love Grant Williams, so I'm very reluctant to cut across him, but I'm on the other side of the trade. Europe has big structural problems in the longer run, but in the short run, what they have had is a little bit of growth. And I think everybody's attributing the Macron win with more settled environment, but really what happened was we got a little bit of growth. We're getting a tiny bit of inflation. And so the markets are a little bit more optimistic. Also, there are a lot of people still trying to figure out, does Brexit make Europe stronger or weaker? And the argument that it makes them stronger because they lose this break, this country that's constantly been a pain and not on board. Now they're not there anymore. So Europe can proceed in its federalist direction much faster and more easily than before. So if you're in favor of that, you go, this is a buy. I like what I see in Europe. Also, we've had some big bailouts of the Italian banks. So everybody goes, you see, they're definitely going to write a check and sort out that debt problem. The Germans have been more vocal about saying, we'll do whatever it takes. I've recently spent time with the people who run what they call Mittelstand businesses. That means big but medium-sized businesses in Germany. I have to say, all those CEOs are like, you know, if it comes down to it, we'll just write the check. And I say, but guys, that would mean like, you know, you might end up with the tenth of the value of what you have in your bank account right now. And they hem and haw and say, yeah, but there really is no price you can put on the value of European Union. And we're prepared to pay that. And we're the only ones with the cash. So, you know, we don't have to pay it all at once. We can drag it out by kicking the can down the road. So that's what they do. The Macron thing is interesting because, I mean, it's like the second coming, you know, it's like suddenly we have a leader who can fix all ails, which I don't see happening. I think Macron has less likely an environment than even Sarkozy had when he was in the same role and he held such promise and never delivered anything. So we have yet to see how this is going to play out. I think that populist forces in Europe still exist. I think they're going to intensify precisely because growth is beginning. Now, that's a bit ironic because most people would say, well, if growth growth is beginning, then populism should go away. But I think people are going to say, wait a minute, I thought that my life would get better if growth came back, and now it's coming back, and I'm still not better off. And the more they see the Italian banks get bailed out, and they say, wait a minute, how come they can find billions to bail out an Italian bank, but they can't find 5 euros to deal with the 40% youth unemployment problem in a place like Italy? So I think the populism is still there, and the people who don't like populism have latched onto the idea that Macron absolutely evaporates that problem, when in fact it doesn't. So we still have an issue. Grant Williams is right. Europe still has a reckoning, but you know, they're able to kick the can a little further down the road because of these events I mentioned.
And what do you see the outcome of this refugee crisis being? We had Italy the other day threatening to issue EU visas to refugees in order to force other countries to do their part to absorb more people. We've seen German politics affected by what seems like a growing divide in the German populace around their attitude towards accepting refugees. Is this going to lead to a bigger problem, or is it coming under control?
I think there is a much bigger problem in immigration coming. And to be clear, I am actually in favor of the freest possible movement of people, which means human capital and goods and capital across borders. But there are always limits, and the socially acceptable limits seem to be in flux right now across Western Europe. So here's the problem. We're not just talking about the magnitude of refugees we've already seen. We're talking about what's coming. And so this is where the Italian threat is very important. And they basically said, look, nobody is helping us, and we get all of them because of our geographical location. So unless you guys give us a hand here, then we're just going to issue them papers and then let them loose, and they go anywhere they want in Western Europe. That, of course, is a bit scary for the rest of Western Europe, which would prefer to have the problem contained. But they're not prepared to help Italy in the containment process, just as they weren't particularly prepared to give Greece any extra money to deal with their refugee problem, which happens for the same reason. But this is the beginning. The bigger issue is that you still have a buildup of immigration happening in Turkey. And the Turks have also been very threatening, saying, you know, if you don't give us what we want, and we've got a long list of things, then we might have parts of the border that, oh my gosh, there's just nobody to police it that afternoon. And suddenly you get a big wave. But even more important than that, I now see Northern Africa becoming more destabilized. So Algeria, Libya, and Egypt all becoming a little bit more wobbly and unstable. And that wave of immigration, I think, could begin to dwarf what we've already seen. In addition to all of that, there's also the fact that everybody in Africa has registered that it's possible to get to the north. And of course, all of them would like to, because they're not stupid. They completely understand that there's a potentially better quality of life and much greater opportunity. So it's not just a temporary phenomena. It's now that people around that part of the world have begun to register, hey, I can get to Europe. Look, turn on CNN and you'll see, which they all can do these days because they got the telephone in their pocket. And so this is the television is on their phone. And this is the key thing, is the realization that movement may be worth it. So they're saying now in parts of even sub-Saharan Africa that the greatest luxury good, the thing that a person will buy when they have any extra money, is passage to Europe. And so this is why there's a really big question about what is the European Union's immigration policy? Do they really have one, or do they really believe in this concept of having basically no border whatsoever? And I think it's a big debate. A lot of Europeans are like, hey, we never signed up for a world where we had no borders at all. And others say, well, if once you're inside the border, you're in. And I recently had a German say to me, for example, the Polish citizens that were in the United Kingdom were not immigrants. They're just European Union citizens. And so this is the type of debate that's occurring. But at the end of the day, there's still no money to deal with them for whatever reason that they're arriving. And so it will continue to be a pressure on finances.
You mentioned Turkey in passing. Let's come back to that, because I'm very interested to get your view on where that situation is headed. It seems like the scale of the rhetoric is increasing. We had the leader of state talking about beheading people the other day. We've had threats not allowing German officials to come in and visit their troops at the airbase there. Where is all this headed?
Yeah. Okay, so this is one of the most fascinating and complex issues on the global landscape today. We have a huge new picture in the Middle East that we haven't really seen before. And that is, we have the new leader in Saudi who is aligned now with Israel, even restoring diplomatic relations between the two countries. And those two basically turned on Qatar. And they did it when President Trump came to visit. And President Trump basically said, hey guys, what do we have to do to get rid of this terrorism problem? And they said, fundamentally, Qatar has to stop giving these people money. They've been doing it in lots of ways for a long time, but it's really getting more severe now. And that's on the back of an interesting event that happened over the last 6 months, which was a big hunting party, a falcon hunting party from Qatar that had several members of the royal family were all kidnapped when they crossed the border and held ransom for quite a long time, 8 or 9 months. And finally, the Qataris said, fine, we'll just pay you to get the royal family members back. And the price of the ransom was $1 billion. I say that with a B for boy so that we're clear. You can imagine that for ISIS, that budget, that's a budget forever. That's not like an annual budget. That's like forever. They are funded. And this is when everybody went, this has got to stop. And plus, Qatar had been a thorn in the side of the rest of the region for quite a while, kind of the upstart cousins that somehow managed to come into a lot of cash because of natural gas and creating some things like Al Jazeera, which was generating not just cash, but influence. So against that backdrop, once Saudi and Israel and the United States and the Gulf Cooperation Council all said, we're shutting Qatar down, Turkey said, okay, let's see whose side we're on here. And I think this is the key thing, is Turkey views themselves as the regional powerhouse, not Saudi, not the Gulf, not Qatar. And Turkey has been cut off by Western Europe. And so what they're doing is jockeying for a position up against these other players. And one way they're doing it is by aligning with Russia. So Russia has also been aligning with Qatar and with, it's all complicated because you would think, no, the Russians are against ISIS in Syria. But it's not just about ISIS in Syria. It's about regional footholds and diplomatic influence. And by the way, the Chinese are in on this too, because they understand the importance of the region. They are now a bigger buyer of oil from Saudi than the Americans are. So the Chinese have been quietly sidling up to all these different players to say, you know, what can we do in the background? And we, by the way, Qatar, like to buy your natural gas. Maybe we can do this offline quietly so that nobody sees the revenue you're going to get from us. So honestly, it's like the Middle East usually is. It's one of the most complex pictures anywhere on the planet.
I want to shift gears now to a topic I didn't used to think of as being geopolitically oriented, which, of course, is your area of expertise, and that's cryptocurrencies. You know, in the beginning, Pippa, if you look at what Bitcoin was at the very beginning, it was something that only interested extreme libertarians who were very interested in financial privacy. Nobody else was paying attention to it. And it was designed, really, to usurp the ability of government to interfere with and control people's finances. And it seems that it's almost going through a complete transformation, where now we have the Ethereum guy, I forget his name, meeting with Putin, talking about some kind of partnership to create a digital cryptocurrency that would become a national currency for Russia. Meanwhile, PBOC is advertising to hire blockchain engineers to help to design the digital yuan, so our digital RMB. So all of a sudden, it seems like what's going on, and I think there was one, I don't remember the gentleman's name, but there was someone from PBOC, very senior official, saying, look, it's time for central banks to stop ignoring cryptocurrencies and recognize that we've got to take the lead and we've got to be in charge of these things and design them to be what we want them to be. Where is this going? And it seems like, to me, this is a game changer if national governments are going to get behind cryptocurrencies. Where does this take us?
Totally. And I think it's a massive market and geopolitical issue. I've written a little article about this, actually, which I put up on LinkedIn, where I said, you got to understand, If the size of your debt problem is so big that it can't be paid off, and in fact, even inflation, which is the usual way you would seek to default on your debt slowly over time, you can't get enough inflation generated, then there is one further option, and that is you literally abandon the entire system of money and accounting. And I know that sounds unbelievably radical, but we've seen it happen before. And I explained the example of Britain in 1834, when they abandoned the traditional system they'd used for 1,000 years at that time, which was called the tally stick system. And so when we say we tally things up, or the word stock market refers to the use of little wooden stocks. There were literally pieces of wood on which you would record every transaction during your life, every borrowing, every lending deal, every asset acquisition, every tax payment. And so since that had, the way it worked was literally a wooden board. You cracked it in half really roughly, so the two sides definitely did match and couldn't be faked. And then the borrower and the lender each, you know, marked all their transactions. And the stock end was always the smaller end, right? So that's how where we get stock market. There was a market in the stocks, these little wooden sticks. Anyway, bottom line was, why would you abandon a system that's worked perfectly beautifully for 1,000 years? And the answer is you had 200 years of war debts that had accumulated. They were unable to get inflation up enough without causing social unrest. And so the government said, hey, let's actually take the tally sticks back and give people this great new innovation called paper money. Now you can imagine, everybody's like, what? I'm going to hand over this record, this ledger of my entire net worth, and you're going to give me a piece of paper? Really? Like, this is a joke. So in the end, what the government had to do was actually confiscate the tally sticks, and they took them to Parliament to burn them. And they misjudged how much heat the fire would throw off. And that is what caused Parliament to burn to the ground in 1834, was the destruction of the system of accounting and money. And in its place, we adopted what we now use, which is a piece of paper we call cash. Now, today, we're on the brink of a similar step change. And the way you'll do it is you're going to move to electronic money in conjunction with blockchain. Blockchain is the new ledger, and e-money is the new currency. The question is, who's e-money? So everybody in government circles have been watching the Indian experience, because the prime minister stepped up to the platform in early November and basically said, okay, we're going to move all of you, 1 billion people, off paper money and onto electronic money, and we're going to do it in 3 months. Well, they did it, and they did it successfully. And so now governments everywhere are saying, hey, we want to do that, because guess what happens when you move to e-money? First of all, you really eliminate the black market, because you can't transact anymore without it being seen. And so, for example, the European Union are talking heavily about, let's move to electronic money, because then all this black market activity that happens in Greece and Italy, where there's no tax, we'll be able to get all that tax revenue off it. And so that's one reason. The second reason is, with blockchain, you have total transparency over every single step of a transaction, complete provenance of every single transaction. Now, the question is, who gets to see it? And I think this is where governments are suddenly a little schizo, because on the one side, they think they are going to have the ability to see every transaction that you and I and all the listeners are engaged in. But Ethereum has created this platform where actually it won't necessarily be in government's hands. It may be in private hands. And the question is, can you trust the private hands who are issuing ethers as much or more or less than you trust governments? And so governments are beginning to say, well, let's create our own version. And that's where you get the PBOC saying, we got to control this, because otherwise you're going to end up with private sector currencies that possibly are trusted more than government currencies. And that will lead to transactions offline that governments can't see. So there was a report going around the internet recently about some guy made $200 million trading on Ethereum in a month. And the question is, well, who will tax that? And the answer is nobody. Well, that freaks governments out, to say the least, particularly given their debt situation. So I think this is a huge, huge thing, and all investors have to think very carefully about it. I'll say one last thing about it. You got to get familiar with quantum computing. And there's loads of stuff on the net about it, but the reason that it matters is because of the speed at which you can process information. We now have quantum computers. The Chinese apparently have the fastest. There's D-Wave out of British Columbia. But basically you can break a blockchain password or a Bitcoin password in like less than a minute if you have a quantum computer. So the question is, who's going to have them? And the answer is mainly governments, but big corporations are buying them like crazy. Volkswagen just bought one. We're going to see major corporations buying that computing power. And the question then is, okay, who has most transparency over the blockchain and e-money? And I would argue it's going to be whoever has the most and fastest processing power, which may be governments at times. It may be private at times. It may be fluid. And that's what we have to think about as investors.
I want to ask a follow-up question on this because you're just the perfect person to ask it of, which is I've written quite a bit over the years about the future of the U.S. dollar's role as the world's reserve currency. And I think it's fascinating that everybody in finance seems to just assume that it's forever. And of course, reserve currencies throughout history, as you know, have changed about once every 100 years. We're kind of due for one. The U.S. has had reserve currency status since 1944, and I would contend that the only reason it still has that status after we came off of the gold standard, it's been really, I think, the petrodollar system that's held it together, and that even is starting to change as the oil market has changed. So it's time for there to be a replacement, and it just seems so clear to me, if you are another government like China or Russia, and your desire as somebody like Sergei Glazyev in Russia has been so outspoken in advising Vladimir Putin that Russia ought to be vying to take over control of the world's reserve currency. The way to do it is to invent a global digital currency, a cryptocurrency that is government-backed that can replace the dollar and become the global trade currency and eventually also become the central bank's preferred reserve asset denomination currency. Am I crazy to think that that's where this could be headed and that the cryptocurrency boom could actually result in the demise of the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency?
You're not crazy. And I think this is definitely the thought process that's in play. But it's very interesting how different governments are proceeding. So I think there's a bit of an arms race on this front between particularly China and the U.S. China's choice is to pursue the analog version of the future, and America and the West's choice is to go for the digital. So let me explain what I mean. The Chinese realized that their economy was coming into a period of not just weakness, but they might have lost their edge entirely in manufacturing. And that's because their wages have gone up so much and basically the costs have gone up so much. They're just not competitive anymore. You probably saw recently that Foxconn has said, the second largest employer in China, that they're looking to build a production facility in Wisconsin. They've been looking in Pennsylvania. And bottom line is, when it's more competitive to produce your iPhone in Wisconsin than Shenzhen, something pretty big has happened. So they decided to pursue an entirely new geopolitical strategy, which they call the Belt and Road Initiative. It's really important for everybody listening to spend time on this because it's the biggest infrastructure build out in modern history. It is all about connecting China to the rest of the world by rail, by road, building highways, airports, ports, physical linkages that are quite literally going across the entire world economy. And their idea is that if they build these roads and linkages, then all the places along the way are going to buy their products. They're going to buy their excess capacity in steel and concrete. They're going to get familiar with their brands. And guess what? They're going to use renminbi. And so this is a way of compelling the world to start transacting with China in their currency. Now, then the PBOC comes in and says, well, actually, we'd like to create a digital version of the renminbi. But what they're not saying is they want a global currency because that would require even their own citizens to have access to the internet. And in fact, what they're doing is the opposite. They've introduced what has been called the Great Firewall, which is kind of like a digital Berlin Wall that keeps the citizens inside and stops them from connecting to the outside. So, for example, the Chinese now cannot legally access the top 3,000 English language websites, including Dropbox and DocuSign and you know, we're not talking about news media. We're talking about the standard building blocks of deals and acquisitions and mergers. So they're forcing everybody onto Mandarin-speaking platforms, which, of course, is tricky for the West. So it's creating a real split. But it's all about that, you know, using the renminbi. And if they have to have a digital element of that in order to retain the greatest control and make it as most flexible as they can, that's what they want to do. The West is going a different way, which is private paths. Private entities are creating their own private digital currencies. Government so far is saying, well, we can't really regulate it, so better join them than try and beat them. And so this is why we see the Western government saying, let's create a digitized version. But their focus is on greater usability, on, like I said, cleaning up the black market. So that's why I say it's interesting that I think the Chinese are going the physical analog route and the West is going a digital route, but they're all competing for who's going to pay for what in which currency. And this is the open question. You know, that is the fundamental question. Like I said, the Chinese are now a bigger buyer of oil from the Saudis and the Americans. So at some point, if the Chinese say, you know, we don't really want it denominated in dollars anymore, let's have it denominated in the PBOC's new digital currency, or let's have it denominated in renminbi, yeah, it's going to change the cash flows in and out of the U.S. economy for sure.
Well, and I would think, too, just as they're used to having an onshore and offshore yuan market, that if they wanted to, they could engineer a digital RMB, which gives them the ability to control both international transactions that are available to transact these digital RMB with international corporations versus in-house digital RMB, which Chinese citizens can use to conduct commerce with each other but are not allowed to go over the border. And it's just a little flag in a bit someplace that's turned on to say whether or not it's allowed to work internationally. So there's probably no limit to the number of things that they could engineer if they wanted to. And I want to ask another question, because I'm looking at the Belt and Road Initiative page on Wikipedia, and it talks about all of this great stuff, building out infrastructure, blah, 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 blah. And I think, well, wait a minute, you know, Donald Trump campaigned on saying all of the same stuff, building airports and roads and so forth. And of course, that was campaign talk, and it's not so far really gone anywhere in terms of any actual big infrastructure spend program truly passing Congress, being approved, and, you know, the cranes are actually building stuff. What's the status of this in China? Is this just Xi Jinping talking about this stuff, or is it really happening?
So it is really happening. It's happening in really obscure places as well. I was recently in Oman in the Middle East, and they are building what will be one of the largest ports in the whole region there, in a spot which currently is a fishing village with 10,000 people. So they are really building this thing. And it's important for everybody to look at the maps. I actually put them up both on Twitter under Dr. Pippa M and also on Instagram, to help people understand just how big this thing is. And so very quickly, it's a physical roadway that goes all the way from eastern China through to the United Kingdom, through to Spain, but also throughout the Middle East. It's railway links. We've already had the very first railway line is completed between London and Yiwu in China. It's already going once a week. It's not even a maybe. I mean, it's live. It goes to Madrid and back to China. They've just announced a third element of One Belt, One Road, and the next bit is called One Circle. One Circle refers to the Arctic pathway, which is a maritime pathway. They are now able to get from Dalian in eastern China to Rotterdam in Western Europe in 26 days, which is a huge event in terms of shipping, but also access to proteins, right? Because the Arctic is full of fish. And the Russians technically control it, but the icebreakers China has are so much faster. They're like, I can't hear you. We picked up a lot of fish, but what? So they, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of focus there. To be clear, the belt refers to the physical roads and highways and railway links. Ironically, the road refers to the maritime Silk Road, which is the maritime pathways that run from China around India into the Middle East, but now also around Africa. And it's in Latin America, too. They are all over Mexico. They are building out the canal in Nicaragua. They're building one of the biggest port on the west coast of the Americas, bigger than Long Beach, will be on the west coast of Mexico. So this stuff is not hypothetical anymore. It's a genuine physical build out, and it's live, and it's important because investors need to decide, is this the thing that bankrupts China, or is this thing that affirms China's place in history? And that's an open question.
And we're going to have a link in our research roundup email that our registered users already received, which will link to the work that you've done on that. I'd love to go further into depth on it, but we'll just refer people to your writings because I want to move on to another topic that you just alluded to, which is post Donald Trump and the wall, which who knows when and whether it's really going to be built. It seems like a lot of the finance community has kind of written off relations with Texas and Mexico as, you know, having any future because President Trump's going to build a wall. That's going to be it. There's going to be no more Texas-U.S. commerce. It's all over. You have a very different view. Please explain.
Yes, I have exactly the opposite view. And it's not that I'm a fan of Donald Trump. I don't like the bluster and the tone any more than anybody else. However, what's interesting is that because Mexico is so competitive, because their wages are 30 to 40% cheaper than China, because their quality control is American standard, because they're so integrated into the U.S. supply chain, actually the wave of immigrants has slowed dramatically. So they're not coming north as much as they were because they got jobs at home. When I go anywhere in the U.S. and I say this to CEOs, you know, chief investment officers, they all say, yeah, we're putting way more capital into Mexico. And we're not at all perturbed by Donald Trump building the wall because we're actually going to use a really nifty piece of technology called an airplane. And we're going to fly right over it, right? So the wall doesn't really do anything to the degree of integration between the two economies at this point. It's classic politics. You're always building a wall 10 years after you actually needed it, right? That's always the way it works. So I actually see that the most dynamic part of the industrialized world, if I have to name what is the hottest economy in the world today, pardon me, in the industrialized world, that's the Texas Midwest corridor. And if I have to name what's the hottest emerging market, it's Mexico. They're right next to each other. I see a massive ecosystem in that the wall won't even touch. So, yeah, investors are gone, oh, that's a dead end. And meanwhile, it's absolutely on fire. And I think there are other pieces, too, like the new Silicon Valley is Austin. I think in terms of technology and innovation, Texas is a leading position in property, agribusiness, energy. It's so diversified. So I see that as the number one place where capital can make a really great return at the moment that everybody thinks it's the worst.
Finally, Pippa, I'd like to go to a topic that I know a lot of people are going to be very interested to hear from you about, and that is the President's Working Group on Financial Markets, better known as the Plunge Protection Team. And if you were to believe in the rhetoric that you see in some of the conspiracy-minded blogs and podcasts on the internet, this is a sinister organization that exists to undermine free market capitalism by imposing government control and manipulating markets, much to the dismay of short sellers and gold bugs and so forth. You have the distinction of having actually served in real life on that so-called Plunge Protection Team. Tell us what they really do there. What was it like and what experiences and insights did you gain from serving on the PPT?
Yeah, well, you know, look, what is it really? It's a working group that is the Treasury, the Federal Reserve, the controller of the currency, somebody from the White House. And so everybody, they call it the plus one formation. So it's you plus one. When I was on it, I was the plus one for the White House. And, you know, basically they're there to confer, to swap notes about what's going on, especially when there's a big emergency. They do have a, quote, trading room. And the trading room is basically a place where they can watch markets and see prices and, you know, see things, how things are unfolding. What it isn't is it's not a hedge fund, right? It's not an entity that can just, you know, enter the market and buy stocks, right? It's not like Hong Kong where they can just say, okay, we're now buying stocks and suddenly the market moves. But it works in more subtle ways. So my sense is, you know, it's a talk shop. It doesn't have anything like the influence that the markets attribute to it. The more important thing is that all of the big financial institutions, they understand that it's better to get along with Treasury and the Fed than to be obstructive or confront them. And I'd go even a little further. I said this in my book, Signals, that a lot of people in government are definitely looking to work in the private sector when they leave. So you don't want to do stuff that's really disruptive to the banking sector if you expect to be named vice chairman of a major bank. And so what I think actually happens is when we're in a big emergency, Treasury knows all of the people in the banking system, right? They're all buddies. They play golf together and they get together and they go, oh, you know, it looks really bad. Yeah, I think it looks really bad. It'd be good if somebody just came into the stock market and bought some stuff. That would be good. Yeah, I think so. Then the order goes out, you know, to the trading floor, buy stocks Monday morning. It's not because they were required to or because the government in any way has issued an order. It's just a sense of, okay, I think government is enough uneasy that they'll do something. Now, nobody asks, what can they do? No, they just assume it's government. So they go, I think they might do something, so we better get in front of this. And this is why the power of words in government is so important. What you get in government, quite literally, when you go serve in any of these roles, you get a pen and you get a flag. It's really important to understand the power of the pen and the flag, because you literally write or you say words and the market moves. So you don't need to actually intervene in the stock market directly or the bond market. All you need to do is put the word out that you're getting a little uncomfortable with prices where they are and you'd rather see them somewhere else. And lo and behold, the market starts moving. So it's not the plunge protection team that actively do this. It's much more subtle. It's much more subtle than that. And it would happen even if you didn't have a plunge protection team. It's just Wall Street sniffing out what's the sensibility of Washington. So having served on it, whenever I read these articles saying that we had so much power and we controlled the markets, I burst out laughing because I thought they couldn't punch their way out of a paper bag. But, you know, perception is everything in markets. And the perception is not wrong that government can influence the tone. I just don't think it does so directly as people think.
So what you're saying is that the trading room that is operated by the plunge protection team is for monitoring only. There is no account with which to massively short VIX futures in order to try to suppress volatility. There's no money to spend on trying to influence prices in the market. Is that correct?
Well, there is one entity, and gosh, it's been so long since I was there, I'm ditzing on the name. It was created to deal with Mexico when Mexico had the peso collapse. And Bob Rubin was there at the time. And basically, they took oil as collateral in exchange for the loans that they made to Mexico. And that created it's called the Exchange Stability Fund, Exchange Rate Stability Fund. Now, that is a pool of money that is available to the Treasury, and they can deploy it in markets. It is subject to congressional oversight, but Congress gets mad as hell every time they actually use it. Because what Congress doesn't like is having pools of money that are not subject to congressional oversight prior to their use. And so in practice, you have the Exchange Rate Stabilization Fund as a mechanism you could use. I think in reality, it's not actually used very often. But the fact that it exists makes the market guys go, they could. So all you have to do, if you were sitting in that seat on the trading floor of the Treasury, is ask for a price. You don't have to tell the market what to do. You have to just call up and say, just checking prices. Well, you check prices at the right moment. Everybody knows which side of the trade you want to the market to be on, and suddenly they all start moving. So again, I don't think that it's really about the direct deployment of capital most of the time. It's really about using the words to create the impression that caused markets to start doing things they might not otherwise be doing.
Okay, well, let's pick up on that then, because recently Janet Yellen and several other Fed officials have been quite a bit more outspoken than they've been in the past, saying, hey, we're starting to get, like, for real concerned now about asset valuations and there being too much froth in this stock market. Does that mean people are getting the memo and the big banks are going to, you know, reverse? Because I think we didn't get into your view on stocks, but I know you've had generally a bullish view that markets are probably headed higher. Do you start to take pause and say, wait a minute, Janet is signaling the powers that be that they ought to put the brakes on. Does that cause you to change your outlook as far as equity markets are concerned?
Actually, no, because this is another thing with the power of words. What government can't do is say one thing and do another and have the markets believe them. So here we have the Fed and every other major central bank in the world has issued a record amount of liquidity into the world economy, and they've done it simultaneously over the last decade. So roughly, let's call it $18 trillion worth of new money in the system, and it's got to go somewhere. Meanwhile, then Yellen says, okay, I'm not very comfortable with asset prices where they are, but at the same time, while I might marginally begin to raise interest rates ever so fractionally and slowly, but I'm not actually going to take back $18 trillion worth of liquidity. We're just in an ocean of liquidity that we've just created. We're taking back 3 drops. Okay. The market's like, I'm sorry, but the stock market's going to go up because you've created the conditions for inflation to accelerate. You have had all this cash sitting on the sidelines, worried about the future. Well, finally, actually, the future maybe is looking okay. Growth is okay. The world seems to be recovering. And so what they're really worried about is all the money they put in the system was fine as long as it sat on the sidelines. But now it's starting to deploy. And so it's a bit like saying, let's throw around all this liquidity because it's like petrol. It's like gasoline. It's an accelerant. It's a make the economy burn faster. But don't worry about inflation because there's no spark. It'll never actually start. And then suddenly there's a spark because everybody goes, you know what? The stock market keeps going up and I can't be left behind. I've missed it the whole way up here. Let's get in. Now it really starts to roar. So people say to me, but stock markets are at all-time record highs. You can't possibly buy up here. And I'm like, yeah, but that's before $18 trillion went into the system. There, whatever was the old high, it's $18 trillion less than it's going to be. Now, I don't mean to say that all $18 trillion is going to end up in the stock market. Some of it will end up in bonds and some of it will stay on the sidelines. But I think whatever amount of money is available, much more will go into the real economy, partly because if growth and inflation are actually coming back, and I would argue they are, the Fed says, no, 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 they're not. I would say, just look at the cost of living that you personally face. Do you feel like your rent is rising? Do you feel like you're paying more for your groceries? Are you noticing that every time you open the darn box of cereal, there's less cereal inside, but you charge the same price? All of that is signaling that inflation, albeit marginal, is starting to get a foothold. In that world, you can't own cash. You're like, get me out of cash. You don't really want to be in bonds. So what are your options? Real economy. You can either buy equity or private equity, or you can go build a business, or you can lend to somebody building a business. These are the main options. And what I hear from the biggest global investors is they are all in on the real economy angle because everything else is so uncomfortable. And frankly, people are innovating. We have incredible innovation going on. I would argue we are in the second industrial revolution. This technological revolution we're in is so huge. People can't afford to not invest in it and be part of this massive disintermediation process. So profits are there and money will find their way to them. And that's why I say, you know, this idea that the stock markets are about to crash, it's based on an old notion of what the all-time high ought to look like. By the way, can I just add the $5 trillion that China's One Belt, One Road initiative adds to this picture as well, like on top of all the rest. You know, so that's a lot of money developing the world and connecting it together better. And you really think everything's going to pull back. So, by the way, last thing on this. Every institution I deal with, if they are telling me if the stock market would just fall anywhere in the world by 10%, we would fall to our knees, thank God in heaven, and buy everything. Now, if it fell 20, they might drop to their knees a little more slowly. But at the end of the day, sooner or later, they've got to do it, especially in light of the fact that we've got everybody's pension funds so massively underfunded and the aging population. We've got to get returns and performance from somewhere. So unless you're telling me this is all going to be worse than the financial crisis, and now people are immune to that because they're like, well, I've been through that and I lived, I survived. So, you know, and okay, government can't do as much as before if we had such a crisis, but they're not completely out of ammo. You know, do we really want to test governments and bet that this time is different? No. If governments want to step in and find a way to issue more money, they will. So it just means more inflation in future, which has been my core bet. Everything they're doing tells us more inflation in future. And that is what you want to get in front of. So I'm all over finding genuine unimpaired cash flows, hopefully enhanced by new technology. You want brands that people will be committed to no matter how rough it gets out there. And so I have to say I'm still long, you know, I'm my argument is stocks are going to go way higher than you ever imagined.
Now, we heard a different view last week from Dr. Ben Hunt, who said, look, the Fed has, you know, we're going through a regime change here. It's been 8 years of adding, you know, the tide's been coming in. We're adding liquidity. We're growing central bank balance sheets around the world. Now we're finally talking about shrinking them, and exactly when they start shrinking them and how much they start shrinking them, it hasn't really been decided yet. But the mood has changed from where's the next opportunity to ease to where's the next opportunity to tighten. If I'm understanding you correctly, it sounds like your retort to that argument would be, look, they just added 18 trillion gallons to the swimming pool. Now they're talking about opening a quarter inch drain hole in the corner someplace. It's just
exactly.
Doesn't matter. Okay.
Well,
so
put.
And it will someday when we start opening really big drain holes, it will matter. But as far as what's being discussed now about the Fed beginning to, I mean, because it could potentially be a psychological signal. We're shifting from growing balance sheets to shrinking balance sheets, even if shrinking very slightly. It sounds like you're not concerned about that trend change.
I hear you. I get it. But let's face it, at the beginning of a rate hiking cycle, this doesn't cause the economy to flip on a dime and turn into a recession. If it does, that means you've made a terrible mistake. Usually what happens is rate hikes reinforce the notion that, oh, hey, we're actually growing. It's okay. The future is going to be better. The Fed feels confident enough that they can take the little liquidity back and do it super gently and give you, you know, 15 warning notices before they do it. So no big surprises. That's an investable environment. So the question is, where's the break even? And I think nobody knows anymore. You can use a Taylor rule. I think John Taylor is a genius. And, you know, his back of the envelope Taylor rule is one way to look at it. Paul Volcker might use a different configuration, a different formula. Both of them would agree that the break even is way higher than it ever used to be. So we would have to have a lot of rate hikes just to get to neutral, let alone begin, quote, tightening. Right now, we're not tightening. We're just normalizing from a truly absurd and historic level of liquidity. You know, once you get back to something with some semblance of being normal, yeah, then we can talk about, quote, tightening. So this is the thing. The early stage is normalization. Later, we actually tighten and constrain the market. But you can't even begin to explain what we're doing now as that phase. The other thing is, again, looking back at history to understand how inflation works and the early stages of inflation, everybody's happy because asset prices are rising and you're not yet registering how much your grocery bill or your rent is going up. And frankly, you are getting wage hikes. And I look at the world, and what I see are wage hikes galore. I see the Chinese are getting wage hikes, right? They've put their wages up by 5 times in 3 years. They look on track to do another 10% per annum. Problems for them. But in the meantime, people's wages are rising in some emerging markets, the big ones that matter. In the U.S., we're getting wage hikes for skilled workers, right? Every chief executive officer says, I got a shortage of skilled people, and I will pay these people whatever they need. There's a surfeit of unskilled people, and they are not able to get whatever they want. That's a big problem. But we have basically two economies, one full of people who are fully employable and there aren't enough of them, and one economy that has too many people that aren't employable under almost any circumstances. And by the way, Janet Yellen is feeding the second economy, expecting that the first one is on fire, but, you know, hey, they're rich, they're educated, they can look after themselves and figure out what they need to do. So again, I come back to the point, if we're in the early stages of the inflation that was intended to be created by the injection of quantitative easing and asset price purchases and low interest rates, then we still have a ways to run. And another thing is markets are so short-term focused, right? Everybody's like, what's the trade for the next 30 minutes, let alone this afternoon? And they forget that things like inflation take time. You know, when the Weimar Republic began the process of flooding the market with liquidity, it took 4 years before the inflation really began. And then when it did, it ripped. I mean, it went fast. Today, I don't think we're going to have that same kind of inflation because technology and technological advances and aging demographics, arguably, although you can make the case the other way, both potentially hold prices down over the long term. But a move from 1% inflation to 2.5%, that is a massive change from the point of view of a pension fund or a big institutional investor. And retail investors should be no less respectful of that massive move just because it sounds small. And so as that gains momentum, this is, again, we're going to see, well, my house price is going up and the stock market's a little higher. And hey, I have been waiting for a long time to do something with my cash. I think I've got confidence now to go build something. And bang, we are off to the races. Then the Fed's going to have to raise rates by more and faster. We'll still have a period of time people go, hey, but that's good. That means we're growing. So I would argue it's not until you actually start to feel the acid erosion, the pain that inflation causes, before people start to go, wait, we're on the wrong road here. That's when you start to hit the break even, you know, area. But we're a long way off from that. The one last thing, and I know I'm talking a lot, but when I look at the map of history, what I see is last great inflation started in 1962. The Fed would say 1965. And it gained momentum, and it was caused by, you know, trying to have guns and butter. Remember the Kennedy administration, the Johnson administration wanted the Great Society program, and they wanted to finance the Cold War. So, yeah, we got more liquidity in the system, inflation began. But it didn't really hurt anybody until the early 70s. And then they tried price controls, and then the OPEC crisis happened, they tried more price controls, and inflation just got worse. Only in 1974 did they start to say, maybe we better do something about this. And from 74 to 79, they argued, is it inflation? Is it unemployment? I don't know. I think it's inflation. It's unemployment. They had the stop-go era where you slammed back and forth between two extreme policy trajectories, and that confused everybody until finally they said, okay, it's inflation, and they hired Paul Volcker. This time, how long will it take? Well, with technological change, the speed at which information and money flow in the economy, maybe it's half the time. Well, that's from 65 to 79. So now, how long is that? Half the time? That's about where we are right now. So we're, in my view, we're just at the beginning of feeling the positive impact of all that liquidity that governments gave us. And we should also be preparing for the negative impact that will come, but it's not yet with us.
Finally, Pippa, before we close, for our listeners who want to follow more of your work, tell us what you do at DRPM Group and where they can find out more about you.
Sure. So I'm advising big institutional investors, but I'm also writing books. I have a book called Signals, How Everyday Science Can Help Us Navigate the World's Turbulent Economy. I put up stuff on Twitter under Dr. Pippa M all the time, and I write on LinkedIn, and I'm really looking forward to engaging with your listenership.
Fantastic. And we will have a link in our Research Roundup email so that they can find your work on LinkedIn and elsewhere on the internet. Can't thank you enough, Pippa, for another fantastic interview. Thanks for coming back and joining us. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Pippa Malmgren. I thought it was really interesting, her bullish stance on the markets. You know, she was looking at all of the liquidity that the central banks have put into the system and suggesting that this will still keep driving the bull market. But then I look at it and hear the words from the variant perception team, whether it was Tian Yang or Jonathan Tepper, and they study the idea of liquidity and when liquidity turns. And it brings to the question for me as to what's more important, how much liquidity was in the system or is in the system, or what is the rate of change of the liquidity in the system? What's your feeling on that?
Well, Patrick, this goes to the stock versus flow argument, which Zero Hedge has written extensively about and which the mainstream media doesn't even understand, as far as I can tell. The way Ben Bernanke insists that this works is that it's all about the change in stock. The money has been pumped into the system. That liquidity exists in the system. And the fact that it's there means that it is essentially crowding out other actors, and it provides this beneficial effect. So as long as the money stays in the system, you get the full effect and the full benefit of it. So Pippa Malmgren is essentially agreeing with Ben Bernanke's view of how this works. What Zero Hedge has argued, and what I think to some extent last week Ben Hunt alluded to on this program, is that a lot of people think that it's really more about the flow as opposed to the stock. It is the addition of new liquidity which is going into buying assets, and that buying is pushing prices up. When you stop buying and you haven't taken the liquidity out of the system, it's still there, but no new buying is going on. It doesn't push the price up anymore. It might allow the level to stay there and not retreat, but it doesn't continue to have the same effect as when liquidity is flowing in. Who's right, Zero Hedge or Ben Bernanke? I guess that's up to the listener to decide.
Well, I'm not going to touch that one, Eric, so let's move on. We've had plenty of listener requests to do a show on cryptocurrencies, but we've never done it, largely because your view on Bitcoins has always been that it's never going to be taken seriously as a currency for doing serious transactions. So I'm sure many of our listeners were as surprised as I was when your comments to Pippo were suggesting that you thought that cryptocurrencies could play a bigger role in the future. So please explain why you seem to have changed your tune here. Are you suddenly turning into a Bitcoin buff after all?
Well, no, I'm not turning into a Bitcoin buff, and I probably never will, but I have very much changed my view about cryptocurrencies. As the old saying goes, when the facts change, I change my opinion. I've been thinking about this for several months, actually. I've been meaning to write a paper about it, and I haven't had time. So let's go ahead and just address the topic here in the podcast. The primary objection that I've had to Bitcoin is what it was designed to do from the beginning was to usurp the ability of governments to control people's lives in ways which the designers of Bitcoin didn't think governments had any business doing. So it is designed, for example, to make it impossible for the government to directly tax your Bitcoin account or to spy on your transactions because there's an anonymity there. It's designed to do all these things that governments are not going to like. And what I've always said is that governments are not going to allow it to ever really come into serious competition with, say, a national currency or something. Well, the picture is now clear to me that cryptocurrencies, not Bitcoin and not any of the other first generation cryptocurrencies, but I do think that cryptocurrencies are going to play a very pivotal, central role in the future of the global monetary system. Well, guess what, folks? I don't think you're going to like it because it is not the view that the cryptocurrency buffs want to have, which is all of these innovations that were invented by Bitcoin are going to be realized. I think quite to the contrary, that what began as a libertarian pipe dream, unfortunately, is going to end as an Orwellian nightmare. But to understand the role that cryptocurrencies are going to play in the future, we really need to take a step back first and understand some background concepts like exorbitant privilege, Triffin's paradox, and de-dollarization.
Now, I'm sure our Macro Voices listeners are keen to hear more, so let's dive in now rather than waiting for you to write that article in your spare time. So let's go in the Wayback Machine to the 1960s when the term exorbitant privilege was coined. What does it mean, Eric?
Well, let's go even farther back than that to 1944, which is when the Bretton Woods Conference established the U.S. dollar by treaty as the world's reserve currency. And the whole concept was based on U.S. dollar convertibility into gold at a fixed exchange rate. So essentially, the U.S. dollar was as good as gold. Foreign holders of U.S. dollars could convert them into gold bullion at an agreed rate of exchange of $35 an ounce. That created enormous artificial demand for U.S. dollars because every country in the world needed to hold U.S. dollar reserves, both as a central bank reserve asset, as well as having a reserve of U.S. dollars to settle international trade. It was Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, my apologies to the French if I'm pronouncing that wrong, the time French finance minister, later went on to become the president of France, who coined the phrase exorbitant privilege. And he used it to describe the ability of the United States to effectively get into debt for free, because the usual result of borrowing excessively beyond one's means for any other country would be that your treasury yields would increase and therefore your cost of borrowing would increase. But there's so much artificial demand for U.S. dollars that the U.S. could effectively get away with going into debt for free. And where other countries would be punished for running large current account deficits, the U.S. was effectively almost needed to run large current account deficits in order to satisfy the international demand for U.S. dollars. Now, whatever you do, folks, do not miss our Euro Dollar University series with Jeff Schneider, which is coming up in the second half of August. We're going to go into all of this stuff in much, much deeper detail, talk about Euro dollars and money supply and so forth. But for now, the point to understand is the U.S. gets a huge benefit from being the issuer of the world's reserve currency. Other countries, understandably, don't like it. At the time, it was France, but it was really all of the other countries saying, hey, you guys get a free ride here. You get to go into debt that nobody else could get away with, and you don't suffer the adverse consequences that other countries would suffer for doing so.
Now, earlier you mentioned this concept of Triffin's paradox. Now, who is Robert Triffin, and how does he play a role in the story?
Well, Triffin was an economist in the 1960s who wrote extensively about reserve currency status of the United States. Now, remember, when he was writing about this in the 60s, that was before President Nixon took us off the gold standard. So the first concept to understand is, why does a currency get chosen to be the world's reserve currency in the first place? And the answer is the strongest credit. Now, go back to 1944, when most of the world is laying in ruin at the end of World War II. The United States never had to fight that war on its own soil. So U.S. was clearly the strongest credit. It was also a creditor nation. It was not in debt the way it is today. It was just a very, very clear call in 1944 that the U.S. dollar should be chosen as the reserve currency because it was the strongest currency in existence on Earth at that time. What Triffin observed is, what is the effect of being chosen as the world's reserve currency? Well, the effect is that it basically gives the issuing country free license to engage in excessive deficit spending, borrowing and spending beyond your means, military adventurism. I think it's fair to say that the U.S. has had its fair share of that since the 1960s, and particularly the accumulation of an enormous and unsustainable national debt. And of course, that too has occurred as we sit now looking at $20 trillion of national national debt. Now, the paradox that Triffin described is he said, look, what gets you chosen as a reserve currency issuer is being the best credit, but having that status of reserve currency issuer basically enables that reckless spending and borrowing that eventually makes you a very bad credit, unworthy of having that status. So Triffin said the dilemma here is that the United States would predictably borrow and spend recklessly because they had a free license to get away with it where other countries couldn't, and accumulate a monster national debt. Well, that certainly happened. And eventually the U.S. would lose that reserve currency status because it was almost forced as a result of being the reserve currency issuer to be reckless and irresponsible and borrowing and spending beyond its means. And eventually it would get to the point where it would no longer be a strong credit and it wouldn't deserve to continue to be the world's reserve currency. Now, some people thought that when President Nixon slammed the gold convertibility window in August of 1971, that had proven Robert Triffin to be right. But Triffin himself said that it really didn't resolve his paradox because the U.S. dollar continued, even after Nixon slammed the gold window, to serve as the world's reserve currency. And to this day, the U.S. enjoys exorbitant privilege of being that reserve currency issuer. Other countries are rightfully upset about that. They don't think it's fair. The most critical point to understand is why is it possible 45 years after Nixon slammed that gold convertibility window, effectively defaulting on Bretton Woods, that the U.S. is still the world's reserve currency issuer? The answer is because there is no viable alternative. There is no bond market in the world other than U.S. treasuries, which is deep and liquid enough to absorb central bank-sized capital flows. It's essential to understand that lots and lots of people around the world, particularly Russia and China, don't like the fact that the U.S. still has this exorbitant privilege. So they're motivated to figure out ways to come up with a viable alternative to the U.S. treasury market as being the only bond market in the world that is suitable to absorb central bank reserve style of capital flows.
And of course, that brings us to the de-dollarization. Now, you mentioned earlier that Valerie Giscard d'Estaing was outspoken critic of the United States hegemony and the issuer of the world's reserve currency way back in the 1960s. But then who is this Sergei Glatsiev and how does he fit into this story more recently?
Well, d'Estaing didn't like it back in the 1960s, but there wasn't much he could do about it at the time because the Bretton Woods gold standard was still in force, and the U.S. really did have a monopoly on reserve currency status. Of course, August 15th, 1971, Nixon slammed the gold convertibility window, effectively defaulting on Bretton Woods. Now, most people think that Henry Kissinger's petrodollar system is the only reason that the U.S. has been able to maintain its de facto reserve currency status, even in the wake of Bretton Woods as a formal treaty collapsing back in 1971. For anyone who's not familiar with that, basically, at the time, Kissinger understood exactly what was at risk if the U.S. were to lose its reserve currency status. So he went over and met with the Saudis and said, look, you guys are a monarchy, you know, the royal family is pretty lucky to sit on top of this huge oil reserve. We're going to make you an offer you can't refuse. We're going to basically protect you. We're going to give you the backing of the U.S. military to make sure that the people who are in power stay in power in Saudi Arabia. What we want is your promise to do two things. Number one, price your oil exports in dollars so that everybody has to pay for them in dollars, not just your exports to the United States, but if you're exporting to France, to China, to wherever, you're going to make them pay in U.S. dollars for their oil. And number two, we want you to promise us that whatever profits you're making from your oil sales, you're going to invest those profits in U.S. Treasury bonds, the safest investment on earth. Well, of course, Kissinger was smart enough to know that they wouldn't be the safest investment on earth unless he could talk the Saudis into this deal, which he did. So ever since, we've had this petrodollar system essentially perpetuating the U.S.'s reserve currency status. Think about everything that's going on in the world these days. We don't really have a situation where the United States is the primary consumer of Arab oil the way we used to. We don't have a situation where they don't have a choice but to deal with the United States. The Saudis can export their oil to a lot of places around the world. Now, Sergei Glazyev is a Russian scholar and an economic advisor to Vladimir Putin. And I think of him as the modern-day Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. He's the guy who has been a very outspoken critic of the U.S. continuing to enjoy this exorbitant privilege 45 years after the collapse of the Bretton Woods Treaty, when a lot of people thought that the U.S. dollar would soon be replaced by another world reserve currency. He's smart enough to see, and by the way, this guy is no slouch. He ran for president of Russia back in the 90s, and he's a very smart guy. He is able to see that the petrodollar story is not really holding up, because Russia these days is as big of a producer as Saudi Arabia, and it has much more influence now than it used to. The U.S. is no longer Saudi Arabia's primary customer, and he's very actively encouraging Vladimir Putin to collaborate with China and other governments to basically lobby other countries around the world to stop using the U.S. dollar for international trade settlement and to use other currencies instead. But it's hard, as much as he wants to replace the U.S. dollar, to push the ruble as a viable alternative, because Russia has its share of economic problems. Similarly, if you look at the Chinese renminbi, it's kind of a closed currency that's not freely convertible, and there's some issues there. So, you know, what's going to be the right thing? He's focusing for now on getting other countries to just transact in some currency other than dollars. But I think a lot of people have speculated that ultimately what he wants to do is see some other currency, that there's some other currency besides U.S. dollars and some reserve asset other than U.S. treasuries to serve as central bank reserve assets. Now, some people think that Russia and China could be conspiring to secretly design a new gold-backed currency that could be suddenly introduced and might upstage the U.S. dollar, and that might be their strategy. What I think is more likely is that the cryptocurrency is going to be the answer, that it will be cryptocurrency that is state-backed, that's designed by China and Russia, for example, or some other national government, that becomes first the new global transaction currency, but also ultimately is the denomination of central bank reserve assets, making it the new de facto world reserve currency.
Okay, well, that's all fascinating background, but let's put it all together here, Eric. So what do cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin have to do with all of this?
Unfortunately, I don't think Bitcoin has anything to do with it. I think that the cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and what I'll call first-generation cryptocurrencies, the ones designed by libertarians for the purpose of keeping government out of our lives, they're not going anywhere as far as I can tell. What I'm increasingly convinced is going to happen is that there will be a new generation of government-backed and sponsored cryptocurrencies, and that is going to be where it's at. Now, the People's Bank of China first floated this idea about a year ago, but frankly, I didn't give a lot of credence to it at the time, because this is the way China does things. They have some guy, professor or something, write a research paper just to test an idea and see how the world reacts to it and decide whether they're going to take it anywhere. So when they first mentioned it publicly, I thought it was just a trial balloon, that they were just waiting to see what the response is going to be. But that was then, Patrick, and this is now. And what we're seeing is that the PBOC is now actively advertising for hiring cryptocurrency engineers to help design the new digital RMB. Meanwhile, the Ethereum founder had a very public meeting with Vladimir Putin recently, discussing the potential of a partnership for Ethereum to work with Russia to create a Russian state-sponsored cryptocurrency. So these things are suddenly speeding up very quickly. This leads me to a number of predictions. I think that the future probably will be defined by a new generation of government-sponsored cryptocurrency that will eventually replace the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency. This will happen at first in the sense of just international trade settlement. It'll take longer after that, but eventually we'll get to the point where there is a new integrated international sovereign bond market. So instead of each country having its own separate sovereign bond market, the idea would be sort of like the way corporate bonds trade today, where there's one bond market and, you know, IBM is going to get a different yield on their bonds than some smaller company maybe, but they're trading in the same market. And what I see eventually is that you have have this global cryptocurrency. Let's call it the Globo for sake of a word to use. What you have is all sovereign nations around the world have their sovereign debt denominated in Globos. So there's no foreign exchange factor that comes into this. And each different country issues its treasury bonds on this Globo sovereign market. And each country, based on its credit rating, is going to end up with different yields, but they're all denominated in the same currency. That currency is the new digital reserve currency. In the beginning, I would see it working just like SDRs do today, where it's a currency that only exists between governments, and it's not something that any individual can hold in an account. But eventually, I would see that giving way to a system where global trade is settled in globos, and eventually individuals have bank accounts denominated in globos. There would be probably parallel existence of globos and national currencies at the same time, but eventually we would go to a single currency system where those national currencies would be eliminated in favor of everybody being on the same digital currency network. So that's kind of the overview of where I see things headed. And, you know, eventually U.S. treasuries denominated in dollars would be replaced by U.S. treasuries that are denominated in globos. Now, U.S. treasuries, because they're U.S. treasuries and everybody's used to them being the strongest treasury asset, would still continue to have that favoritism, at least initially, but they would not be denominated in dollars anymore. They would be denominated in globos.
That's really interesting, Eric. Some really insightful ways that things could really play out in the future. Now, earlier, though, you said something about this becoming like this Orwellian nightmare. And the question I have for you is where does that nightmare part come into play in all of this?
Well, the whole focus of the design of the first generation digital currencies like Bitcoin was that they would prevent governments from doing things that the designers of Bitcoin didn't like. So, for example, the transaction details and who owns the Bitcoin wallets and so forth were anonymous, meaning that governments can't spy on your financial activity or seize your bank account. Transfers were secure and irreversible, meaning that once you get paid, nobody, including the government or the person who paid you, can renege and take those bitcoins back. They can't stop payment on the check after it's been issued. The size of the Bitcoin money supply was very ingeniously designed using mathematics to roughly simulate the scarcity characteristics of precious metals. So there was no way for central bankers to be able to dilute the value of your bitcoins by pressing a button someplace with quantitative easing and just printing up a bunch of more, because the system was designed to prevent that. There is no QE for bitcoins because Bitcoin was designed to prevent something like QE from being able to happen. So all of these were the primary objectives of the Bitcoin design, was to prevent governments from doing things that the designers of Bitcoin and I don't think governments should be able to do. Well, my prediction, unfortunately, and folks don't think I like this, is that instead governments will steal the most brilliant innovations of those first generation cryptocurrencies, and most notably that's blockchain, which is the secure distributed database technology that enables the ledger of Bitcoin to be essentially hack-proof. What they'll do is they'll take those brilliant engineering feats of the first generation cryptocurrency engineers, and they will redeploy them in a completely different way that is the antithesis of everything that Bitcoin stood for. So government will be able to trace absolutely everything in the system. They will always know exactly who the owner of every single wallet is. They will know exactly all of the transactions that ever occur in the system. They will indefinitely, after a transaction occurs, have backward ability to go and scan it and analyze it and follow your finances. It will become impossible for anyone anywhere to conceal any wealth anywhere on the planet from taxing authorities, because the very definition of money will become this new digital cryptocurrency. And by design, if you have any money whatsoever in this system, the government knows exactly how much, when you got it, and who you got it from. Governments will have the ability to directly seize and tax your wealth. So there won't be a need for the IRS to chase after you. They'll be able, without a court order probably, to just push a button and lock any portion or all of your assets in this cryptocurrency. And just like the chargeback system works today for credit cards, first the money disappears from your account, and then you get to fight to try to get it back. So if the IRS doesn't like something, you know, they're going to take the money out of your account And you can file a lawsuit to try to sue them and get it back if it turns out that you were wronged in some way. Governments will be able, I predict, to claw back transactions that they consider to be unjust or illegal. So, for example, there was a story a few years ago about a guy in Texas who sells his pickup truck that has advertising on the door to a used car dealer. Somehow, some way, that thing finds its way over to Iraq, and it's carrying ISIS fighters and arms around, and they're shooting people. Well, in the future, what I predict is the government will have the ability to unwind that whole transaction, which means the poor guy in Texas who sold his pickup truck, all of a sudden, that money disappears out of his cryptocurrency account. Now, maybe he can argue, well, it wasn't my fault. I didn't know that the car dealer was going to sell it to terrorists. But again, probably what happens is the money is gone from his account first, and then he has to fight through the court system in order to get it back. Governments will be able to affect blanket wealth taxes, so they could remove a certain percent of everyone's money directly from your account without your consent. They could just as easily accomplish the same thing, but probably confuse more people and make it less obvious that it's happening by simply issuing new crypto coin supply that to the government itself. So they're effectively doing quantitative easing on this new crypto coin currency and giving the money back to themselves. I predict that central bank monetary policy options would expand, not contract, under this system. Negative interest rates are easily implemented because there's no cash hoarding incentive, because hoarding cash becomes impossible. Quantitative easing or quantitative tightening of crypto coin supply happens at the touch of a button. I predict that holding any significant wealth outside of the system will eventually be prohibited and made illegal. Anyone caught doing it will be presumed guilty of terrorism or supporting terrorism until proven otherwise. And my biggest prediction is that who issues and controls this new global cryptocurrency will become effectively the space race of the 21st century. The U.S. is not going to stand by and watch Russia and China, who may already be collaborating on this, just take it because they were first. There will be a huge race. There will be a massive battle between governments as to who's in charge of this thing. It looks to me like China and Russia may already be working on this. It will probably be designed by some small coalition of countries, for example, China and Russia. And I would imagine it being designed, at least initially, so there's an idea that the government control functions, such as being able to freeze accounts and tax wealth directly, those would be put in the hands of each sovereign state over its own citizens. So in other words, Russia would have control over Russian citizens' wallets, United States would have control over U.S. citizens' wallets. But the tax havens around the world would be eliminated, because what would happen is the stronger countries would say, we're sick of these tax havens, we're sick of people having the right to leave our country and go someplace where they're not taxed so aggressively. So whoever we deem to be a tax haven, we're not going to give those countries control over their citizens. We're going to have the global central bank keep control of that, because we don't want to allow people to avoid taxation on a global scale just by moving out of the country doing the taxing to one that does less taxing.
Well, I can't think of any other quote than the Chinese proverb that says, may you live in interesting times. And I can tell you that our future is going to have some very interesting developments, and it's maybe even some scary thoughts in terms of how things will play out. Nonetheless, are there any other subjects you want to touch on in this week's episode?
Patrick, if there's any one person on earth that I would really love to interview on this program, it would be Sergei Glazyev himself, to give him a chance to tell his side of this story. And of course, people would say, oh, that would never happen because the Russian government would never allow it. I don't buy that. I think that the Western media doesn't give the Russians the opportunity to tell their side of the story, and I think they would welcome it. So I would love to find a way to get Sergei Glazyev to do an interview about all these topics and what his intentions are with this de-dollarization strategy that he's been recommending to Vladimir Putin. It would be challenging. We'd have to work through a translator because, to the best of my knowledge, Sergei Yurevich does not speak English. If any of our Russian listeners have Mr. Glazyev's ear, please help us set this up. I think it would be fascinating in this age of propaganda in the West to hear the Russian side of the story directly from the Russians, not what the CNN commentator thinks the Russian side of the story is. But on that note, we're going to have to wrap things here. We are way over time with this episode. So folks, you know this, you've heard it before. We really need your help promoting the show. Please retweet us, tell your friends about Macro Voices, donate if you can to help us us defray our production costs using the donate button on the website. Most importantly, though, register your free account at macrovoices.com, because the more registered users we have, the more able Patrick is to recruit the very best feature interview guests. Benefit to you is that you'll receive our research roundup email, which never contains advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all the coolest free stuff that we could find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
Well, in this research roundup, you're going to find a transcript for today's interview. There's also a link to an article from an emerging markets investor who wrote the article, Learning to Love Volatility in Emerging Markets, as well. Jeffrey Snyder put out an article called All Conundrums Matter. You'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric directly on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com. And we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.